Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Recorded in 2000, Michael R. Rose, Professor of Biological Science, and Gregory Benford, Professor of Physics at the University of California, Irvine, discuss what they think the future holds. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
So, the thing I was interested in discussing is the question of the nature of the future in its broadest sense. I think that in the past, as exhibited in many science fiction novels, but not only in science fiction, but political ideology, we've had a kind of Hebrew-Greek-derived collectivism, which has dominated our imagination, which has led us to think of a future in terms of some gigantic utopia, or some gigantic dystopia, possibly with a renegade individual or individuals. This is obviously 1984, Orwell's novel, Brave New World, Aldous Huxley's novel. And I think that's really the imagination of the past. And what has to be, I think, becoming clear to more and more people is that our future is going to be much more sort of chaotic, in a sense individualist, but more than that, in a sense almost psychotically visionary. Really a future that, you know, I think sits better with Philip K. Dick than the Old Testament.
That's interesting. Actually, that's much more of an entertaining future than you see from all the amateur prognosticators who are really just political commentators in the larger media. Trying to imagine the next century as being driven by a whole lot of unforeseeable choices is, I think, you're right, a more productive way to go about it. But if you really want to understand the kind of themes that might emerge, well, I'd suggest that, to use a rubric that I have in the past, if you look at the 20th century as being primarily determined by the implications and inventions of physics, a fact which was becoming visible at the end of the 19th century, and the 19th century had been driven primarily by mechanics and chemistry, a view which was common, by the way, at the time of the American Revolution, that those would be great formative things, the beginnings of industrialism. Then, certainly around 1990, it became apparent to a lot of people that people in your line of work, the biologists, were going to be the legislators of the big issues of tomorrow, perhaps even inadvertently. But the difference is, for me, that when you try to look at what issues are going to be chaotically rendered, indeed biology is tailor-made for this. Because while physics can depend upon an engine of industrialization, you know, it takes a factory to make a plane or even a radio, it does not take a factory to make a baby, or rather the factory is walking around on two legs. The modification of the genome holds open all kinds of wild cards, and you can already see the forces marshaling against the freedom to use that. In fact, the big battle of the 21st century will be around biologically informed issues, of course modified by increased computerization and so forth, but also marshaled by the issue of who gets to control it. And it will be, again, I think, the state versus the individual. And I'm not optimistic that in a lot of places the individual win out, whereas I feel that rightfully the individual should. What do you think?
Okay. Well, I think that's a great point about biology versus physics. Actually, it makes me think, you know, of if the last two or three centuries ideologically have been dominated by economic systems where people have been arguing about collectivist socialism versus unbridled rampant capitalism, and pure forms of those being seen as better than dilute, weakened forms shaped by compromise, I think that era is over. And there really isn't anything interesting about it anymore at all. I mean, who cares about those old debates, because it's patently obvious that socialism doesn't work unless you basically take a modified form of capitalism and call it socialism, which is sort of what Swedish politicians did at one point. But basically everything now is variants of capitalism. What the Chinese, the mainland Chinese, are doing is capitalism with lots of state corruption, which is something that's well known to Western history. So that's not even interesting. But I think the issue you raise is very interesting. And one thing I've often wondered is the following point. We don't just have a surging biology. We also have a surging world of artificial intelligence, of information, you know, sometimes called a superhighway, a term I dislike. But basically, in a sense, what you have is science being used either to create, you know, silicon chip-based prosthetics, which computers are an example of, but only one example of, versus science used to push the body of the individual and make the individual more powerful. And in some ways, you can see these as competing visions. In some ways, you can see them as complementary. But in any case, I think there are two huge themes that, in a sense, ideologies of the future might trade off on. Those people who, for example, are ideologically committed to modifying their bodies so that they are stronger, so perhaps they live longer, so that they have physical abilities they otherwise would not have had, versus those people who clearly feel an emotional horror at the idea of doing any such thing to their bodies and want to live as naturally as possible and instead just have, you know, toys that are, you know, manufactured and kept separate from their bodies, like computers and MP3 players and all the other technologies. I think that's a great context for, will be an important context for division and strife, maybe someday warfare. That's hard to predict. However, I really have to say that I think that the collectivist dream, which really was the animating dream for some people in the latter half of the 19th century and for most people, really, in the 20th century, I think that's over. And our world is stuck with actually dealing with people seriously again, as real people, as real individuals. Now, you might well say that, well, the state will try to squelch that. And sure, I think states will try to squelch that. But the burgeoning of various technologies has really made it incredibly hard, especially incredibly hard if you want to have a dynamic, powerful economy, which states want so that they can get themselves paid for.
Yes.
I mean, basically, it's sort of like, if I may use a simile here, it's like the state is, you know, the mafia operation, and they want their people on the street to have enough freedom to operate so that they get more money. They get more resources and more power on the street. And if you just have really stupid soldiers out there in the streets who don't do anything that enhances the power of the mafia operation, it's in trouble. Similarly, if the state were to try to close down freedom of thought, freedom of expression, the internet and all of its equivalents and variants, then any such state would be in trouble. In particular, its economy would not grow as quickly. And I think in some weird way, the Russians realized that, you know, in 1989, and that was part of why they sort of gave up being dictatorial, because being dictatorial just wasn't working in a more and more complex economy. So I guess, in a sense, I'm really optimistic about the relationship between the individual and the state. But that isn't to say that I don't think there won't be spectacular conflicts between individuals and states and between states and states over some of the really difficult issues.
I wish I were as optimistic that this classic opposition will not result in state-sanctioned, essentially, totalitarianism, because it seems to me that already, as you've seen at conferences, there is a religious and ethical argument against changes in biology, particularly, weirdly enough, against obvious improvements such as extending the human lifespan, as you found recently at a conference sponsored by the Templeton Foundation. And these people honestly believe that they are espousing an age-old doctrine. And in some ways it is, of course. The weirdness is that it makes elementary errors. For example, it equates the natural with the good without inspecting it. So therefore, typhoid is maybe good. You have to look at it carefully on a case-for-case basis, I guess. The point is that many people, not just these academicians, do feel not so much that they should be restrained from using the new technologies that will become flooding out of the cornucopia of biology, but perhaps that other people should. I mean, never underestimate the power of the Puritan impulse.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right about that. But I think it's important to differentiate between what you can do in a Soviet Stalinist state or a Nazi state led by Adolf Hitler, in which the state is geared to crush individuals in large numbers and many individuals cooperate with that. That's one thing, which was very distinctive in the 20th century. Another thing is the endless backbiting, criticism, delaying, stalling, impeding, co-opting and corrupting influence of one bunch of people on another bunch of people, and in particular the effect of establishments of various kinds, not just military establishments or political establishments, but even university establishments, religious establishments, clubs and other social organizations, charities. All of those bodies characteristically are conservative. All of those bodies typically resist change. They always will. That will never change. Just as, on the other hand, individuals, given the opportunity, will always seek their advantage, which sometimes may be profit in the case of a marketplace, or sometimes may be corruption in the case of a different kind of society than a market-based society. So, I mean, I suppose I see that clash as age-old. That clash is absolutely continuing. I just think that the old, very intense monolithic beliefs in collectivism, which dominated society really around the world from 1850 to 2000, are really fading very seriously. And you're going back to a period more like that between 1700 and 1850, when really states were looked on with suspicion and most of the dynamism came from the non-state part of the society.
Well, gee, I hope you're right, you know, but, you know, suppose I counter with this, that socialism is actually the working out in large measure of the emotions of envy and malice. Essentially, I don't want anybody to do a whole lot better than I do, and I'll call it social justice.
Yes.
Now, if you apply that to this future, in which biology doesn't just mean, oh, we'll cure this disease, maybe we can make you live longer. But what happens when you get to the two stages of what I call editing? We're at the beginnings of editing out. Everybody seems to agree that if you can spot in the genome of potential parents a potentially lethal gene, such as, well, a predilection towards, say, kidney disease or some other affliction we generally agree is a bad idea, people will allow you now to edit that out on a case-by-case basis, looking at the products of your fertilization and simply aborting those who don't fit it. That's crude technology, but it exists now. Notice how much opposition there is to abortion right now, particularly in the United States, and how hard a social issue it has been to overcome. Well, abortion will look like nothing compared to first there's editing out bad characteristics, which will open the door. But what happens when you start editing in? Or you pick traits which not everybody agrees are a bad idea. Suppose, just a thought experiment, there was a gene for shortness, particularly in males. And parents would say, particularly if there was an anxious, short father, he'd say, you know, I'd like to be sure that my son could play basketball. Who's going to stop this couple from editing out shortness? Or editing out black hair, if they don't like it?
Well, people are already starting to do these things with things like growth hormone, which, you know, in the young fosters growth, in the older, you know, the mature human does not generate growth, but it is thought by some that growth hormone is an anti-aging substance, which is, at the scientific level, very controversial. So we're already in that future. We're already there. And I agree with you that, of course, people always like to allocate things to themselves or arrogate things to themselves and deny them to others. That seems to be, you know, basic to tribal sociology. You get to a group of more than like two or three people and bang, you've got it. Sometimes this can happen between two friends. Endless patterns of envy and hostility. What was distinctive, I think, from 1850 to, well, 1989, roughly, was the spectacular and really bizarre notion that this was good, that it was good to be envious, that it was good to be malicious towards one's, you know, fellow person, that there was really an ideological righteousness about everything that squelched the individual, that crushed them, that prevented them from going on. Kurt Vonnegut's vision of Harrison Bergeron being crippled and humiliated by an Eleanor Roosevelt-like figure. This was the dominant vein in social theory from 1850 and 2000. It's now being preserved in a kind of game-preserved fashion in Western universities, where the faculties of humanities schools and departments retain the ideology of 50 years ago and 100 years ago. And if, in a sense, it's very quaint that they do that. And it's good for young people to go to universities and be exposed to these professors who have these absolutely bizarre notions.
An intellectual museum.
Exactly, or a museum of intellectuals, where they can be exposed to these ideas so they can be in some ways inoculated from them and not be too damaged by them if they encounter them later in life. I think that that's wonderful. But of course, in the real world, you know, we've moved on radically. I mean, if you just read news magazines today and think about what you used to read in news magazines 25 years ago, it's a spectacular difference. I mean, 25 years ago, some variant of socialism and interventionism in the Swedish system was regarded as like obviously correct, and now it's regarded as obviously wrong. It's been a wholesale change in received opinion in the world at large outside of the universities, and maybe a few select left-wing presses. And that's really the future that we're dealing with. And I agree with you about the biology. I think also there are many issues associated with the informational technologies. They're not viewed quite as emotionally as the biological ones. It's not as bad as abortion and eugenics and genetic engineering, all the things that we will be dealing with in the 21st century big time. And nonetheless, I think you can see that these are the issues. It's the, in a sense, the issue of our powers as individuals. Because really, if you look at what biology offers, it offers the reworking of the biology of the individual body. It doesn't change our societal biology. It's the biology of individuals. The technologies of artificial intelligence in its various forms offer enhancements to the power of individuals or individuals in networks of individuals, which are, from what we've seen so far, highly individualistic on the net. So I really see these things as being what I regard as part of the new future, as part of a future in which the powers of individuals are the preeminent issue, where the powers of the collective are subordinate issues, where, yes, clash between the collective and the individual will go on, but, you know, we're very much in the driver's seat, I think, for at least the next century. Some people might optimistically say forever, but I'm not that optimistic. Maybe we'll get back to a new Stalinism, a new Nazism, new variants of fascism. May come about, I don't know. But certainly for now, it's hard to see them on the horizon.
Hmm. You know, it's useful sometimes to think about even terrible things like Stalinism and fascism. I mean, the new socialism of Europe, so-called. I predict that when this thing idea comes around again, it'll be called new socialism. But it will simply be either the national socialism of the Germans or the communist socialism of the Russians or the nanny state socialism of the Europeans. Nonetheless, they speak to a profound desire to keep the boundaries of the human experience at least within control. And sure enough, when I said people kind of agree about editing out, taking out bad genes, when it becomes possible for first the rich, it's always the rich who can afford these things at first, and then the well-off, to edit in for their children. Wow, it's going to open a hell of a lot of the old calls about privilege and the class structure. You could reinvent class warfare as a biological issue in the sense that the descendants of
the well-off, will be taller, have blonde hair, a better smile, maybe be more intelligent, live longer, better kidneys, the entire routine, and they'll be better people. There will be a terrible fear that this will, in fact, in some way betray the general commonality of humans, or at least people will say it that way. I mean, the argument almost always in small tribes is about whether someone really is human. That's why when your reference to Philip K. Dick is, he often called into question humanness and in fact talked about the anxiety of pushing those boundaries. Well, we're going to push those boundaries really hard in the next century, and a lot of people will go for the prohibitionist stance that you don't want to go there.
A lot of people will do that. The real question is whether, in a sense, the state will. If the technology had come along in 1930, the technology of radically altering our biology, which is just about to hit, I could just see Stalin and Hitler modifying the bodies of their soldiers to make them still more powerful and more deadly and more able to cope in combat and so on and so on. They definitely could have done that if they'd had our technologies. And there's no doubt in my mind they would have done that. And it would have been in the service of the collective. But now that I think those visions are really, if not dead, at least submerged or in a quiescent state compared to most of the last 150 years.
But not the prohibitionist impulse.
Well, the prohibitionist impulse, yes. I mean, no question. I think right now it's very active in Western Europe. The idea of you're not allowed to do things is sort of the whole European lifestyle. And one of the amusing things is how sanctimoniously proud the Europeans are of the fact that they bind themselves up, you know, as vassals to their states. The United States seems to have, at least for the moment, an ostensible ideology of giving people privacy. I mean, the whole abortion rights thing, as a deep issue in terms of the Constitution, is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that you own your own life. And of course, abortion is, in a sense, the worst issue, the margin issue, because another life is involved in some sense as well. But a lot of the things we're talking about don't involve another life. A lot of things we're talking about involve you changing your biology because you want to. I mean, another perhaps more paradigmatic case is insulin. Insulin keeps thousands and thousands of people alive, and it gives them a vastly greater quality of life than not having insulin would. And we will have many insulins in the 21st century. There will be many substances, many modifications that will enhance people's lives. And of course, the real point to make is if you just think about it in terms of enhancement of what we have that's good already, well, yeah, that's probably fairly minor. The biological reality is that essentially from the age of 30 on, we're all going into the abyss. We're all aging, often very spectacularly so, aging, especially after 50. So, you know, the argument that all we are doing is remedying a problem, I think, can be taken quite far and lead to many consequences for our lives, particularly our lives after the age of 30. I mean, the truth is that human beings around the age of 20 are physiologically spectacular. It's just amazing what they can do. And of course, human beings around the age of 70 or 80 don't have that status anymore. So substances or remedies that will address that will be intensely desired by many individuals. You may well have, as I think you do now, rumblings from the federal government and NIH and other institutions of the establishment that they don't want those things to happen, but just try to stop them, given the American Constitution. This is, I mean, if there's a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, if there's a right to abortion, most definitely there will be a right to take substances that will, in fact, enhance your health and vigor later in life. So the whole thing, the issue is going to be joined. However much Congress, NIH, or whatever may want all of this to go away, large-scale, profound modification of the human body that will enhance its functions is coming. There will be conflicts about it. I think at least in the United States, it won't be completely squelched. The Europeans may squelch it for a long time, and eventually they'll go the way of the Americans, as they have so often in the past. It will happen yet again that the Americans lead.
I think you're probably right, but you know, let's not underestimate the ferocity the Europeans have shown. I mean, the whole furor over genetically modified foods what are they going to think about genetically modified people? I could see a future in which people who have certain things modified in their genome will not be able to get into certain countries. They'll be excluded for that reason, as pure vengeance.
Really. And will they be totally oblivious to the analogy between that and the treatment of the Jews in the 1930s?
Probably so. Because they'll say, of course, that they have the natural on their side.
Yeah.
The natural.
Like the Aryan.
Because what's coming under threat here is the entire idea of the natural. The idea that you naturally know it. Mm-hmm. That you can, like art, I'll recognize it when I see it. The trick, of course, is that the natural will probably look better. That is, it really will give you better appearance or better health, something like that. Of course, some people may choose some modifications that don't look lovely.
They already do.
Yeah, they seem to. If you look at hairstyling. But, somebody may choose to have his or her children be inevitable basketball players and so make them 7 feet tall, which is not really a great life. And then, in a real sense, when can the state intervene to stop parents from modifying children beyond certain limits? That's going to be an interesting question because we don't have any boundaries. But some people will maintain that parents don't have any right at all to modify beyond the usual roulette wheel of genetics.
I think there's some important comments to make here. In some ways, this is a recapitulation or an analogy to the history of the last 150 years. When people advocated socialism really didn't know certain very basic things about the way economies work. Yes. I just mean market economy. I mean the way any economy works, that it has to have a price structure, and in particular that it has to have allocation of capital goods. But it's amazing how many of those points have become part of general knowledge, and you can read about them even in places like Time and Newsweek today, the way you always could in The Economist. But similarly with biology, in the next 100 or 200 years, I think, there are certain basic facts of biology which right now most people don't know that they will have to come to understand. The most important of these is there is no such thing as the natural within any species. Yeah. Every species has variation. And the average is by no means necessarily the best. And in particular, what is coming out explosively out of modern biological technologies is greater and greater knowledge of variation in human populations, and of course, like populations of animals and plants generally. And that variation is really one of the most important things. If you don't really have the variation, you can't evolve. If you don't have variation, you can wipe out an entire species with one infectious disease. Instead of the Spanish influenza of 1918 wiping out, a few percent of the human species, it might have wiped out everybody if we'd all been natural. That is to say, if we'd all been the same ideal type. So really ideal types, ideas that really come from places like Plato and Aristotle, intellectually speaking, are patently wrong when it comes to biology. Having discussions about biological issues in a moral context or even really in an ideological context that do not include a knowledge of modern biology are doomed to failure and irrelevance.
So, yes, certainly it's true that the one-size-fits-all idea about biology cannot work, and it makes no sense, no scientific sense. Is there anything more subtle in biology that you think most people are going to have to come to understand in order to negotiate this century?
Well, so the first point is that variation is real. It's not
good.
Merely minor. I guess the second thing is aging, in the sense that we spend most of our lives, if we're lucky, if we lead a Western kind of lifespan, we spend most of our lives aging. And the aging occurs for really profound reasons, not for incidental reasons. It's not a question of how many glasses of orange juice you drink in the morning, or whether or not you eat walnuts with your breakfast, or how often you go for a jog. Aging is really profound, deep, and merciless. It's like, the forces of the atom in atomic physics. And a biology that addresses problems like aging has to be a deep and powerful biology. Powerful really beyond the understanding of many biologists. That's the second thing.
Yeah.
Third thing is sex, which is the thing, of course, in polite, biblically based societies you're not supposed to talk about. But in terms of biology, especially the biology of an organism like ourselves, sex is a preeminent fact of life with many, many consequences, not the least of which is the spread of contagious disease. Because sex is a wonderful way for pathogens, especially pathogens that will kill you slowly, like HIV, to spread from individual to individual. So this makes, for example, policies like the Roman Catholic policies opposing prophylactics devastatingly destructive, because they fly spectacularly in the face of that part of biology that the Christian church has always wanted to cover up and suppress as much as possible, sex.
So what are people going to have to learn about sex that they don't know now?
Well, genetically speaking, sex is, like a lot of things in biology, both very good and very bad, because sex is what makes it possible for recessive genetic diseases to hang around in the population. Diseases like cystic fibrosis, which is one of the more severe diseases that hangs around in the human population. It only does so because we're a sexual organism that recombines genes and can take carriers of such deadly genes who are not themselves affected, put them together as mates, and produce offspring that are devastatingly affected.
But of course, it's advanced biology that can take that away by simply telling you the information.
Well, and advances in biology enable us with greater and greater power and authority to cope with all of this biology, all three of these points of biology, variation, aging, and sex. But since those are very much becoming ideological issues, just like abortion.
Yeah.
Because abortion relates to the variation and the sex issues, both. Discussions, political discussions of these issues that are ignorant of the basic biology are as stupid as discussions of socialism, which just sort of imagine, you know, we don't need currency, we don't need a market economy, we can just like love each other and there'll be no problem, man. Hey, it's 1969, we're all at Woodstock, there's no problem. Well, it's the same way with biology. I mean, basically everyday language and thinking about biology is pretty much firmly in the period 500 to 1000 BC. Mm-hmm. It's essentially defined by ideas from the Bible and Greek philosophers, especially ideas about what is natural.
Yes, but we see people staggering into fields in Europe and in the U.S. Assessing crops they've never even seen before, tearing them up because they're genetically modified, sometimes tearing up the wrong crops because they don't know how to tell one plant from another. It doesn't stop them from being aggressive in their views.
Well, it's just like the ideological denunciation of capitalism by a whole lot of people who have no understanding of the workings of a market economy.
That's right.
It's precisely the same thing. Mm-hmm.
So maybe the best way to offset the naturalism of some people is to, in fact, insist that individuals can make choices and to make your bulwark that of individual liberty and say the collective does not have its right to enforce any controls upon, say, human reproduction at all, period, or the details of human self-modification.
Well, I think this is why the United States, for at least yet another century, will lead the world. Because the United States is a constitution which gives individuals rights to do things, not all of which may be well advised. I mean, look at tattooing and piercing, but which they wish to do, that are part of their private domain. Mm. So that in the United States you see efflorescent biotechnology. In the United States you see individuals really pushing the margins. You see movements that revolve around the prolongation of the human life.
Yeah.
Whereas in Europe, Western Europe, you see all kinds of forms of resistance, all kinds of groups of people who stand for saying no to change. And I think very significantly, they're really saying no to thinking at a level that is beyond about, you know, 50 BC.
Yes.
They're really wedded to either biblical or Greek philosophical notions about what is appropriate to do. And they do have, in many cases, control or influence over the apparatus of the state and will stop exactly the things that are going on right now in the United States that I think will gather momentum and will transform the world.
Yeah. So this kind of philosophical nostalgia you hope won't be able to hold up, but it bothers me as an American, of course you're a Canadian, to notice that the United States did an experiment with essentially victimless vice back in the 1930s and 20s called Prohibition. And it learned its lesson in about a decade and stopped doing that. But now we've been in the war on drugs, which is all essentially about telling people things they can't do with their bodies, for over 30 years. And it's a centerpiece of everybody's administration. It swallows up many times more than our entire space program. And yet we don't seem to have learned this lesson either. In fact, the signs are that the United States is slipping backward in this regard, that people really do feel that they should be able to intervene in what other people do with their bodies.
Yeah, I think that the war on drugs is, the war on drugs conceived criminologically is patently stupid. A war on drugs conceived psychologically or sociologically, namely, you can really mess yourself up with some of this stuff, and you shouldn't, therefore, use it. Which, I mean, in a sense, the criminological war on drugs, which will never work, a la Prohibition, which never worked, is preventing the taking on of a potentially effective war on drugs, which would really involve, you know, psychological and sociological persuasion, hard ethical considerations being dealt with, and so on. I mean, the temperance movement of the 19th century, especially the late 19th century, you know, was a movement to get men to stop what they had been doing quite a lot of in the preceding century, which is to become drunk and dissipated and alcoholic and abandon their families and just wreak havoc in society at large. And in many ways, you know, we, since we no longer have Prohibition, the temperance type of ideology is at work and in many ways working. You know, there's far more control of doing really dangerous things like getting drunk and driving than there was, you know, for a very long time. And that, I think, is really constructive. I mean, I don't sit here and say, you know, look, we should do everything we can all of the time, anytime, with anybody, anyway. The thing about, you know, one of the things that happened with capitalism, I mean, in its original dominant ideological form, up until 1850 or so, a lot of the people who argued for it were really in favor of unbridled, practically vicious capitalism, which society largely rejected, and I think in retrospect we can see was totally unnecessary. I mean, you can be gentle around the edges. You don't need to have orphans starving in the streets.
No.
That does not really help your economy enough to make it worth doing.
Exactly.
And similarly, you know, I don't think one can argue for the unbridled exploitation of any kind of drug, any kind of biological modification, or any kind of prosthetic device, so that we, you know, have our children born and then immediately cut off their hands and have them have mechanical prosthetic devices attached to their arms in lieu of those old inefficient hands. I'm not arguing for that. But I'm saying that, you know, these issues are coming. These issues are the issues of the next 100 or 200 years. What will we do with ourselves, our bodies, and these issues will be worked out in a largely non-collectivist vein.
Yeah, that I agree with, but and it is worth noting that such temperance movements to try to ameliorate the downsides of all kinds of indulgences works better when the activity is legal and can be out in the open and can be intercepted. It's very hard to control drug use when druggies are automatically criminals and therefore hiding from you. It's hard to reach them with a persuasive campaign when you can't identify them. We haven't learned that yet, and that's what bothers me.
That's more, you know, biblical thinking. You know, you make a prohibition against something and that's your solution.
And it's worldwide.
Well, I think attitudes to drugs vary. To some extent, the United States has imposed its ethics on other countries by treaty systems for the control and regulation of these, quote, controlled substances, close quote. But, you know, sooner or later, it's going to be realized this approach doesn't work.
It will fall. I mean, you can smoke marijuana legally in almost no place on this planet now, but it will come.
Well, I mean, the really, I think, interesting thing there is that, of course, The use of those kinds of substances, like marijuana, is widely tolerated in many countries.
Yes.
And basically ignored. A beautiful example of the way you get sort of implicit legislation by the sort of ignoring laws, the same way you used to have in this country, all kinds of laws regulating sexual conduct, very specifically regulating mm-hmm. sexual conduct, which over decades and decades, in some cases centuries, and laws dating back to the 1700s, people basically forgot about them and ignored them. Yeah. And they were only enforced in cases of, you know, patent police persecution of individuals. And I think that may be one of the scenarios with drugs, that people will basically realize, you know, this is stupid and all kinds of people do this and we're more and more ignore it.
Yeah, although there's a long-lasting damage. We got the mafia out of prohibition. And out of the war on drugs, we have an enormously enhanced internal police force, which goes barging into lots of other situations. Branch Davidian is a perfectly good example. Because they've got all these tools and they really like to use them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, one of the most fascinating aspects of political and social systems is the interrelationships between individuals within society, sub-governmental organizations within society, and governmental organizations within society, and all of the strains and interactions between those things, and the way, for example, organizations like the mafia sort of become pseudo-governmental in some ways, but of course very rapacious, and then in other places and times, perhaps, the government becomes just like the mafia. You know, the old Indonesia before the upheaval was basically a very large mafia operation. It's a fascinating sort of kind of tension. I mean, a tension that, of course, has existed throughout all of recorded time. I think greatly exacerbated in the past, the last century or so, by a very dominant ideology of collectivism, which has faded out or died. And in the future, I mean, I won't predict the triumph of individualism as an ideology. That would be way too optimistic, I think, to assert. But you sort of had the collapse of collectivism, and now it's sort of like loose. What many things have become possible, there's a great deal of chaos, there's a great deal of confusion. The kind of chaos and confusion that I think is really beautifully rendered by people like Philip K. Dick, Samuel R. Delaney, people like that, in modern science fiction, as opposed to the old style of science fiction, like people by H.G. Wells, and of course Aldous Huxley, George Orwell, which is really collectivist and really all about the collectivist issue, the collectivist questions. And that sort of thing is, in my opinion, if not dead, then patently passé. It's really out of the loop in terms of where we're going for the foreseeable future.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.